From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the atomic bomb in the age of President Donald Trump and a nuclear North Korea. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas is home of the Pantex facility in Amarillo. It's an important part of the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons complex. The Pantex plant is the primary U.S. nuclear weapons assembly and disassembly facility that aims to maintain the safety, security, and reliability of the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile. And things are very busy these days at Pantex. The Pantex plant is one of three nuclear weapons sites in the United States being considered to produce plutonium pits, the explosive cores currently held at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. This is part of the United States' effort to upgrade and modernize its nuclear weapons arsenal. The federal government is planning to spend $1 trillion on this endeavor. This comes at a time when there are renewed nuclear threats to America, now coming from North Korea. North Korea's advancing nuclear weapons program and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's aggressive posture towards the U.S., South Korea, and Japan is unnerving arms control experts and American leadership. On September 4th, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, spoke at an emergency meeting of the Security Council. Haley gave a lengthy summary of North Korea's flouting of international law since 1993. She concluded that diplomacy has failed. Haley said North Korea's recent sixth nuclear weapons test was a clear sign that the time for half measures from the UN had to end.
Nuclear powers understand their responsibilities. Kim Jong-un shows no such understanding. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
Here's what President Donald Trump had to say about North Korea and a possible American response on August 8th.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I spoke with Dan Zak about these developments. Zak is a reporter for The Washington Post and the author of the book Almighty, Courage and Resistance and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. I asked him about the U.S. president's authority to order a nuclear strike and if there are any limits on that authority.
The president has sole launch authority. He's the one person who can decide to send the missiles or to not send the missiles. The president is supposed to have at all times with him a small card with the nuclear codes, which he would use to authenticate his order. And once that order is given, authentication is passed down through a mainframe that goes all the way down to, say, the missile launch officers underground in Montana and North Dakota.
And also there's the football, which would be like a suitcase with electronics that would be able to communicate with the launch central.
The card has a nickname called the Biscuit that's supposed to be on the president's person at all times. The football, the briefcase you mentioned, is always nearby him, too, when he's in the White House, when he's on vacation. And the briefcase is a 45-pound leather-clad briefcase that contains essentially a menu of strike and response options. The president can essentially order or choose from, depending on what the military advises and what needs to be done in the moment.
Is that menu, is it restricted to retaliation, or is it first strike ability?
You know, the menu is obviously classified, but the U.S. has not ruled out, as a matter of policy, a nuclear first strike. That is still technically on the table. And so I would theorize that, yes, among those options in the football is a nuclear first strike.
Now, this framework that we have for the president being able to authorize, be the sole person who can authorize nuclear strikes, came about over time. And is this enshrined in law?
You know, it's not. But the reason that it developed as a matter of procedure is because of the suddenness with which we could be attacked during the Cold War. You know, the Soviet Union and the U.S. developed missiles that could deliver nuclear weapons at high speeds. And so there needed to be a streamlining of decision-making and response. So, you know, the president, if there's an incoming volley, if we're talking during the Cold War, wouldn't have hours and hours or days to convene meetings about this. Congress wouldn't have time to get together to vote on it. And so this procedure developed where the president has the sole authority to launch. Of course, these days, and back then for that matter, there have been arguments made that this type of procedure, this type of hierarchy is unconstitutional, that no one person should have this kind of power, the power really to end the world if he wanted to.
Yeah, it is the power to end the world as we know it, or maybe even eliminate all life on the planet. Is that an exaggeration?
I don't think it is. I mean, right now there are just under 15,000 nuclear warheads on the planet. You know, that number has come down greatly. During the height of the Cold War, you know, I think there were upwards of 60,000 nuclear warheads. So there's been a lot of dismantlement in that respect. However, a group called the Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War several years ago put out a study that said, If 100 nuclear weapons were exchanged between India and Pakistan, which are both nuclear armed powers, 2 billion people would die. That's billion as in B, as in boy. And that's not just because of the explosion, but because of what would happen to the atmosphere, what would happen to agriculture globally. So if you think about 100 nuclear weapons killing 2 billion people potentially, or endangering them at least, you know, think about 15,000.
And then we have the expression after a nuclear exchange that we have the living envying the dead.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at the accounts of Hiroshima and Nagasaki now 72 years ago. You know, those were very crude nuclear bombs that we dropped on those Japanese cities. They were trials, really. And we've had 72 years to refine them. And so to read the accounts of Japan and what happened and what the experience was like of living through a nuclear detonation, it's kind of unimaginable. And now we've multiplied the power of these weapons by many times.
So back to how this mechanism that we have, we put a lot of trust into the President of the United States as the Commander-in-Chief. Yet now there's some people wondering about whether or not we need to have some safeguards. Some are saying maybe there should be some congressional supervision, particularly if there's going to be a first strike.
Yeah, and in fact, just this year, or within the past year, Representative Ted Lieu of California and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts co-sponsored legislation in Congress saying that if the president wants to order a nuclear first strike, he's got to come to Congress first for approval. You know, I'm not sure whether or not this legislation is born out of the Donald Trump's ascendancy to the White House. Certainly Hillary Clinton made an issue of Donald Trump possessing the nuclear codes during the campaign. But there has been an active, if small, effort in Congress to try and actually legislate some restriction around this.
Yes, during the presidential debate, we saw that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, they both agreed that nuclear weapons are the single greatest threat to the U.S. security, but they differed very greatly on what to do about that. Clinton was in favor of the nuclear deal with Iran, and of course Trump was saying that that's not what we need to be. We need to be beefing up our arsenal, not trying to downgrade or reduce the number of nuclear weapons. We need to be increasing our nuclear stockpile. So where are we with our nuclear stockpile?
Well, right now, we are embarking on a $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T as in Thomas, $1 trillion modernization plan of our nuclear warheads and the delivery systems that take them to their target. Those are the missiles, the bomber planes, and the submarines that we use. This modernization plan was essentially put into action by President Obama, so that predates President Trump. In order to get the New START treaty with Russia ratified by the Senate, President Obama essentially had to agree to this modernization plan. It was time for these devices to be overhauled, to be refurbished, and that's happening right now, and it was happening before Donald Trump came to office and talked about increasing the power of these weapons. You know, there's debate about, are we increasing the power of these weapons? Some people would say, no, we are not. We are merely refurbishing them to make sure that they're safe and effective like they've always been. Of course, critics would say that we, as part of this modernization, are introducing new capabilities to them. For example, the B-61 gravity bomb, the nuclear weapon, that is being partially refurbished in Texas, in just outside of Amarillo at the Pantex plant. We are introducing a guided tail kit and a dial yield that would make this particular gravity bomb more accurate.
And so when you say, just be clear, when you say a gravity bomb, it means it's just pulled to the ground by gravity, just natural gravity. It's not a sci-fi gravity bomb.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we have bombs that would be delivered via missile, and then we have bombs that we would drop from a plane. So the B-61 is what we would drop from a plane. And as part of this modernization plan, you know, we are putting a tail kit on it that would make it more accurate. And critics say, well, that's introducing a new capability, and we've said we won't do that. So we're on this very costly modernization plan. Of course, you might say that, well, if we're going to have these weapons anyway, they better be safe and reliable and not allowed to go to seed. But of course, there are plenty of people who say, well, a $1 trillion reinvestment in this arsenal that we've actually pledged by treaty to work to get rid of, that's kind of an action in bad faith.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Washington Post reporter Dan Zak. His book is Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Threat in the Nuclear Age. We're seeing a renaissance, a rediscovery of this anxiety about the danger of nuclear war.
Yeah, the book that I wrote, Almighty, is it looks at one particular incident that's recent. The book does have a good deal of history in it about the American nuclear identity from the Manhattan Project onward. But the reason I wrote it was because of an incident involving a nuclear weapons facility in 2012. You know, I mentioned the Pantex plant in Amarillo. Well, another weapons plant in Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville, was the site of a fairly serious break-in. Three peace activists in the middle of the night in July 2012 hiked a wooded ridge, cut through four fences, and got into this facility. It's called the Y-12 National Security Complex, where we process and store nuclear components, nuclear weapons components, and nuclear material. And these activists got up to a building that is the storehouse for our highly enriched uranium, maybe the largest stockpile of highly enriched uranium, of fissile material in general, on the planet. And they were able to get up to the outside of this building with great ease. And this was highly concerning. And so the core of my book focuses on these three activists, what they did, why they did it, and the reverberations that came from this break-in. So I think, at least for me, my attention to nuclear weapons began because of this 2012 break-in in Oak Ridge. Certainly, as I mentioned, the 2016 presidential campaign, I think, brought some more people into the fold, into paying attention about this, by virtue of Hillary Clinton making an issue of Donald Trump's temperament.
Right, but this break-in in 2012 by this trio of peace activists, they were certainly motivated with concerns about the Almighty, about God. They painted streaks of human blood and they spray painted these biblical passages, but it was all very much motivated by the fact that these weapons are a crime against humanity to manufacture and to possess, to aim at other countries, and eventually to use.
Yeah, these activists came from a tradition of civil disobedience that's very rooted in Catholic and Christian social justice. What they wanted to do with this break-in in 2012 was actually act on words from the Book of Isaiah and the Bible. You know, the words, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks," essentially transform the tools of war into the tools of peace. And so they took this fairly intrepid and, the government would say, criminal step of breaking into this facility to essentially label this site with what they believe is the truth. Like you said, they view nuclear weapons as immoral and also illegal under international law, that they are designed to kill millions of people, and that we should not be modernizing them, let alone possessing them. And you know, the title of my book was an attempt to bridge the power of these destructive weapons, the almighty godlike power of these weapons, with the faith that motivates activists like these to risk their lives and the lives of other people to make a point.
The United States is not the only country with nuclear weapons. Or actually, there's a proliferation of countries getting nuclear weapons, including now Iran. They're going to get them eventually, and now North Korea has them, and now they're looking for a way to deliver a nuclear payload. So things, the security problems appear to be getting worse, not better.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the number of warheads on the planet has gone down, but the number of countries with them has gone up. We're now at 9 countries that possess nuclear warheads. I think that number, I can't say whether that number will change. The Iran deal blocks Iran's path to a nuclear weapon for 10 or 15 years, and you know, we'll have to see what happens after that, or if there's some kind of follow-on deal. And obviously in the past 2 weeks, North Korea has it's been determined that they're able to make a warhead small enough to fit on a missile that can go long enough to threaten the United States. So that further complicates the international security situation.
They were mainly concerned about the continental United States. It seems like if we hit some, Guam, that's the United States. They could probably hit that if they wanted to, right?
It seems like they can hit both if they want to. That's the determination that has been made. The threat against Guam was just one more step in this chess game that Kim Jong-un chose to make, that rather than directly draw up plans to and publicize plans to strike the continental United States, they saw it in their interest to make the threat against Guam. You know, the United States has several Pacific Ocean locations for military, which obviously we use as a bulwark, but also use in terms of radar to detect any launches out of Asia.
Pakistan is a nuclear power. Are we concerned about them?
Well, talking to security experts in Washington over the years, the number one concern in terms of can a nuclear conflict break out is India versus Pakistan. Nuclear-armed neighbors that historically have not gone along, that continue to skirmish over land, specifically Kashmir. And there's great concern that that kind of skirmishing, the fight over land, the melting of glaciers around Kashmir that might cause some kind of agricultural crisis, that might cause some kind of conventional war that might then cause some kind of nuclear war, that is a conceivable scenario. And as I mentioned, there is that study that shows, you know, a quote-unquote regional nuclear war involving, you know, 100 nuclear weapons just in India and Pakistan. The destruction and the threat would not be limited by their borders. A nuclear war between regional countries, between neighbors, would have impacts around the globe.
It's been 70 years since nuclear weapons have been used in war. And you have to wonder, how is it that these terrible weapons exist but haven't really been used against another country since the United States did it to Japan? And there are some people who say having nuclear weapons will actually stabilizes countries because the prospect of mutual annihilation is so great.
Yeah, for activists believe or are motivated by faith that these weapons are immoral. And on the flip side of that are people in Washington, for example, who have faith that the existence of these weapons actually protect us, that because of nuclear weapons we have not had World War III, because their existence makes the concept of war so abhorrent that no one would dare start one. So that is a doctrine, that is a faith that definitely exists. Of course, the complicating matter of that is the threat of terrorism. And a terrorist or a terrorist organization is not necessarily deterred by mutually assured destruction, which people credit with the relative global peace since World War II. I think concerns abound regardless of where you are on the spectrum of believing or not believing in nuclear weapons.
But the other complication to the idea that nuclear weapons can bring stability and peace, as long as you have people understand that it could bring about mutual destruction, is that you have mature people in office who have control over the weapons, who are rational and are not prone to excited behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that's always a concern. And it was interesting during the 2016 campaign that for the first time in my memory, the presidential candidates were not talking about other countries' nuclear weapons or talking about the ones that Iran doesn't have yet. They were talking about our own. And we as a country, because of the candidacy of Donald Trump and because of Secretary Clinton's making an issue of his temperament, we were asking ourselves, or we were reminding ourselves, what is the foundational authority here, or what is the ultimate power that we are investing in one person by voting for them? And it really is sole launch authority over the most powerful and dangerous devices we've ever created.
The North Korea situation is still ongoing, and there's concerns about their nuclear weapons and their intention. And is that just media hyperbole, or is that bloviating, or is that real?
You know, it might be all of the above. I myself, I'm not a North Korea expert, but I read and talk to some, and there are some that say this is a preeminent concern, and there are some that say yes, the media is overinflating this to the benefit sometimes of Kim Jong-un. But you know, if you get rid of all the opinionating and all that, you know, the fact that the U.S. and its partners have been unable to prevent another country from attaining a capability to threaten the United States and the world, really, is a bad thing and shouldn't be diminished. I mean, my rule of thumb with all of this, I guess, is that when you're talking about weapons that could destroy entire cities, that could theoretically end human civilization, hyperbole is not necessarily a bad thing.
Not only is the question about if the president is level-headed and going to react with reason, those things may or may not be the case, I don't know. But the other side is going to look at the president and have those same questions. And if they think that the president is capable of first strike based upon an impulse, that's a destabilization.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Donald Trump that he has said throughout the campaign is he wants to be unpredictable. And, you know, I think the nuclear weapons structure around the world is kind of predicated on stability. You know, mutually assured destruction, that notion that, you know, allegedly keeps everyone at bay is predicated on stability. And so when you start to introduce uncertainty into something as serious and precarious as this, you know, there's the opportunity for misunderstanding or miscalculation or accident.
It seems like during the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, and he was very intent on trying to dial down the nuclear arsenal and bring some peace and put the minute hand further back from a nuclear Armageddon, that we kind of fell into this mood that we had survived the Cold War.
Yeah, I mean, when the Cold War ended, I think we lost our focusing agent for nuclear weapons. I mean, I was born in 1983, so I was born into the Cold War, into a world that was obsessed or fixated on the threat of nuclear warfare. But I came of age after the end of the Cold War, so nuclear weapons for someone like me at 33 years old have mostly existed as one or two lines in a history textbook about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then only as kind of a plot point in a blockbuster action movie. But, you know, it wasn't until I started working on this book, Almighty, that I recognized that even though the Cold War had ended, nuclear weapons hadn't ended. They've diminished in number, sure, and they've receded from the popular imagination, but they are still the foundation of U.S. National security strategy. There are still, as I said, just short of 15,000 warheads all around the planet. And there are something that I think people should be thinking about on a regular basis.
I've seen some people refer to the situation with North Korea as the stupid missile crisis. But still, is that a wake-up call maybe for your generation or for others who felt like we had passed this situation, that it's like nuclear weapons are still out there, this is still serious, and they demand to be treated seriously?
Well, I hope it's a wake-up call. The other kind of motivating factor I would point to is not just North Korea, which obviously would, you know, easily get headlines and might scare people, but you know, the other thing is I would go back to this modernization plan, this financial reinvestment in this stockpile, which I think deserves attention, especially from younger people. We're paying for it, but it also ensures that this arsenal in its current form, which many people, including security experts and former government officials, say is kind of outdated in this post-Cold War era, but it reinvests in this arsenal over 30 years and essentially into the 2080s. Some of the submarines and components of this modernization ensure that this arsenal will be financed or ready and available for generations to come. So decisions are being made in Congress, in Washington, about money. And that is what... that is what ensures the kind of continued presence of these weapons. And if you are someone who's young and disagrees with the possession of these weapons or just what we're doing with these weapons, you know, I would say that one thing you'd want to look at is the money, because that's what ensures its longevity.
Dan Zak is the author of Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. Zak is also a reporter for The Washington Post. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.